the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
This evening we're starting a new series in the Old Testament book of Exodus entitled From Captivity to Covenant. The book of Exodus is, of course, storytelling on a grand scale. It's a story of fire and sand, wind and water. It's the story of two mighty nations, Israel and Egypt, led by two great men, Moses the liberating hero and Pharaoh the enslaving villain. For the Jews, it is the story that defines their very existence, the rescue that made them God's people. For us as Christians, it is the gospel of the Old Testament, God's first great act of salvation. What the book of Exodus reveals is that there is a God who saves, a God who is prepared to act in order to deliver his people from bondage. Now the word Exodus means exit or departure. It first appears in the text at the beginning of chapter 19. Exodus 19 and verse 1 says this: On the first day of the third month after the Israelites' new moon, after the people of Israel had left Egypt, on that very day they came to the desert of Sinai. When the Hebrew scriptures were translated into Greek, the verb used for their leaving Egypt, the word chosen for had left in the verse I've just read, was the word Exodus. Eventually the word came to be used as the title for the whole book. So Exodus is a story of departure, an epic journey from slavery to salvation, from captivity to covenant. And that idea of journeying is one I'd like us to develop over the next 3 months as we follow in the footsteps of God's people coming out of Egypt and going into the wilderness. For the people in the story, the journey was a physical pilgrimage towards the land of promise. But for us, it's a spiritual pilgrimage as we slowly uncover the major themes that the narrative reveals to us. So what is it that we need to do in preparation for this journey? Well, firstly, I would suggest that we need to keep in step with our fellow travellers. Some of the sections of the story that we are going to be looking at are quite long, and we won't be dealing with every verse. So in preparation for each leg of the journey, Sunday by Sunday, you may find it's helpful to read the passage before we venture out. Secondly, we all need to be on the lookout for several features within the story of the journey. Features that will become increasingly familiar as the story unfolds, many of which are also clear signposts towards the bigger story of the Bible. In the preface of Tim Chester's commentary on Exodus, he writes this: The story of deliverance from oppression has inspired liberation movements from the Pilgrim Fathers and the English Revolutionaries of the 17th century to the anti-slavery campaigns of the 19th century and the civil rights movements in the 20th century. Its cry of "Let my people go" has echoed down through the centuries. But Chester then goes on to say that the message of Exodus is far more than a deliverance narrative, and he names several themes, some of which we will come across often within the scope of the story of the series. These then become the features, if you like, the signposts we need to look out for on our journey. Themes like liberation and sacrifice, God's presence, service and worship, mission and our story. But what do we know about the story itself? Who is the book's author? And when did the events described in the book take place? Well, it's almost certainly true that Exodus wasn't written in a single sitting. Some parts of the book, especially the stories and songs, may well have been passed down by oral tradition and included at a later date. Yet much of the story seems to be written by Moses himself, and we have evidence for that from within the text. On several occasions, we are told that Moses writes about his experiences. He knew how to write, of course, because he had been schooled in Pharaoh's court. In chapter 17 and verse 14, he writes at God's instruction. This is what we read. "Write this," says God, "on a scroll as something to be remembered." And then later on, when we get into chapter 24, it's Moses who takes the initiative to write his own account. This is what we read in Exodus 24, verses 3 and 4. "When Moses went and told the people all the Lord's words and laws, they responded, with one voice everything the Lord has said we will do. Moses then wrote down everything the Lord had said. And whilst it's likely that sections of the story were written down by others, especially the parts that describe Moses in the third person, when Jesus quotes from Exodus, in, for instance, Mark's Gospel, he attributes his quotations directly to Moses. So maybe that ought to be our default position as well. The second thing, of course, that we need to realise about the book is that it is a one volume of a five-volume work, the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy and Numbers. So it's not surprising that Exodus often looks back to promises that God made to the patriarchs, people like Abraham and Joseph in Genesis. And whereas Genesis tells the story of the creation of the world, Exodus tells the story of the creation of a nation. In respect of when the events described in Exodus happened, well, there appears to be two predominant theories. As we will discover as we read the story, the name of the Pharaoh ruling over the nation of Israel at the time of the Exodus doesn't appear anywhere in the text. For some scholars, that's enough evidence to cast doubt as to the historicity of the story as a whole. But either of the two leading theories concerning the dating of Exodus are perfectly compatible with the biblical account. There has, as you would imagine, been much ink spilt over this issue. Some scholars favour an earlier date, round about 1440 BC, whereas others suggest a later date, close to 1270 BC. In the final analysis, none of the arguments on either side appears to prove decisive. Either theory could well be true. Those favouring the earlier date appeal to 1 Kings 6 verse 1 and Judges 11 verse 26, which includes seemingly specific spans of time since Exodus era events. These scholars also point to archaeological findings at Jericho in Palestine and both Amarna and Thebes in southern Egypt. But those who choose the later date think that the references to the Egyptian cities of Pithom and Ramesses in Exodus chapter 1 verse 11 are crucial. They also treat the numbers quoted in Kings and Judges as being symbolic. And since Exodus does not specify the Pharaoh by name, identifying the ruler at this critical juncture relies almost entirely on the dating issue. So those who hold to the earlier date argue for Amenhotep II. He was known for his military excursions, including campaigns into Canaan. But after 1446 BC, his military activities in the area abruptly cease, which would be consistent with the Egyptian army's Red Sea disaster. Also, since his oldest son didn't inherit the throne, as would have been customary, maybe the reason for that is because he was the victim of the 10th plague, the death on all the firstborn sons. The later date for the Exodus suggests Ramses II. He ruled Egypt from 1279 to 1213 BC, gaining fame for his military excursions. And he was particularly renowned for his great building projects, which could easily have included the work mentioned in the opening chapter of Exodus that we have read together. And while some argue that the Pharaoh must have died in the Red Sea with his Bible, with his army, the Bible doesn't say this explicitly. So Ramesses could have lived many more years, matching the dates attributed to his reign. Not surprisingly, no clear Egyptian record of the enslavement and exodus of the Israelite people can be found. It was a matter of great national humiliation, after all. In a land where the ruler enjoyed divine status, a story that showed him as having feet of clay wasn't likely to endure. Furthermore, the Egyptians were a proud people who rarely, if ever, mentioned military defeats in their own records. Their records tend to generally read more like propaganda. So we can hardly expect them to write about how they lost hundreds of elite soldiers in a failed attempt to capture runaway slaves. And in that respect, of course, the Bible is unique amongst ancient documents for providing the most unflattering information about the people who wrote it. One Jewish scholar and writer, Professor Nahum Sana, wrote this: "The story of the Exodus cannot possibly be fictional. No nation would be likely to invent for itself and faithfully transmit century after century and millennium after millennium an inglorious and inconvenient tradition of this nature. the book of Exodus presents the Israelites as a grumbling, complaining, idol-worshipping people. It does nothing to encourage us to praise them. Now, you may have noticed already, if you've looked at the term card, that each of the headings that we have chosen for the various sections of this series start with the word God. Now, there's a particular reason for that. Since the book of Exodus is a God-centered book, reading Exodus leads us to an encounter with God. The book is all about the mercy, justice, holiness, and glory of Almighty God. When other biblical writers refer to the story of Exodus, you'll notice that they rarely mention Moses at all. Instead, they choose to speak of the wonders of God. And this gives us a hint that the proper way to study Exodus is to pay close attention to what the book is showing and telling us about the character of God. And ultimately, the story of Exodus finds its interpretation in the person and work of Jesus Christ, something we were able to recall on Maundy Thursday when we thought about the connection between the events of the Last Supper and the events describing the Exodus and the institution of the Passover meal. In many ways, the Exodus story sets the pattern for the life of Christ. Like Moses, Jesus was born to be a saviour and was rescued from his enemies at his birth. Jesus also spent time in Egypt, and like the children of Israel, Jesus passed through the waters of baptism. Also, like the Israelites who wandered in the desert for 40 years, Jesus went out into the wilderness for 40 days. And what all these connections and others show is that the Exodus is not just a gripping story of rescue from physical slavery. It's also a story that points forward to an even greater story. Since Israel's deliverance from Egypt anticipates the salvation accomplished once and for all through Jesus' death and resurrection, a rescue from spiritual slavery. So let's have a brief look at the start of the story of the book, the verses that we have already read together as we read the entirety of chapter 1 and the first 10 verses of chapter 2. Firstly, it's helpful to remember why the Israelite people were in Egypt in the first place. They didn't start life in Egypt as an enslaved people. The story is way more complicated than that. As the story of Joseph in the latter part of Genesis reveals, the sons of Israel, as mentioned at the start of Exodus chapter 1, were invited to come and live in Egypt as the honoured guests of the then Pharaoh. Joseph, one of Jacob's sons, had risen up through the ranks of the Egyptian government through God's divine intervention. He had saved Egypt from famine through careful and frugal planning. As a reward for his service, the then Pharaoh invited the entire fledgling nation of Israel, a familial group of approximately 70 adults with children, to settle in the land of Goshen. It was a generous gift, a gift that ensured their survival since the same famine that threatened Egypt, of course, was sweeping across the land of Canaan too. In fact, when you think about it, the Pharaoh whom Joseph worked alongside became Israel's saviour. In chapter 45 of Genesis, Pharaoh tells Joseph this: "Tell your brothers, do this, load your animals and return to the land of Canaan and bring your father and your families back to me. I will give you the best land of Egypt and you will enjoy the fat of the land." You are also instructed to tell them, "Do this, take some carts from Egypt for your children and your wives and get your father and come. Never mind about your belongings, because the best of all Egypt will be yours." But the fortunes of God's people were overturned when a few generations later a new dynastic family took over the throne of Egypt. And with the ominous words of chapter 1 verse 8, the fate of God's people was dramatically altered from prosperity to persecution. This is what we read. Verse 8 of chapter 1 of Exodus: "Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt." So often, of course, when it comes to political power, it's a matter of who you know. Unfortunately, the new Pharaoh didn't know Joseph, and because of that, he felt no sense of obligation to his descendants. Gradually, the Egyptians were encouraged to fear the Israelites, and then to hate them, and then finally, they wanted to enslave them. Like most dictators, this new pharaoh was hopelessly insecure. Despite his power, the more foreigners there were in his country, the more alarmed he became. Sunni immigrant population grew so large that he believed it might even destabilize his grip on power. Pharaoh worried that the next time he was attacked, the Israelites would join forces with his enemies, outnumber his own army, and bring his dynasty to an end. So Pharaoh uses the threat of possible attack as a pretext for persecuting foreigners. Because no one spoke up for the people of Israel, their experience went from privilege to persecution, from being honored to being hated, from inclusion to infanticide. But this isn't just an ancient story. It's a very modern one. 3 millennia of history hasn't changed the human condition. Blaming things on ethnic minorities is always convenient because racism is part of our broken human nature. Which is why we need to be the kind of people who follow Christ's example, who seek justice for those who are marginalized, who work for equality in all areas of society, especially those places where systemic and institutionalized racism is allowed to flourish. All people are made in God's glory. God's people were created to be free to serve him. But by making the Israelites his slave, Pharaoh tried to prevent them from fulfilling their calling. Pharaoh also rejects God's promises. God had covenanted to make his people into a great nation. So the more numerous they became, the more his promise was seen to be fulfilled. But in Pharaoh's eyes, God's promise was being rejected and his plan resisted. And when Pharaoh came to the realization that captivity and hard labor was an ineffective way to curb the population, since as verse 12 tells us, the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, he devised a new strategy. He signed the order to enact what he believed would be his final solution. He instigated infanticide against the Jewish people. And it's at this point that we start to see God's hand at work. When a couple of chapters further on, Moses encounters God in the wilderness, God says this to him. I have seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. And the way God intervenes is both surprising and unexpected. But it's an action that actually becomes something of the pattern for the whole of the Bible narrative. God uses people who are seemingly powerless to achieve his purposes. Listen again, if you would, to the verses of Exodus chapter 1, verses 15 and 16. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shipra and Puah, when you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe them on the delivery stool, if it is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live. But as we read on in the story, we learn that these two women did something incredibly powerful. They said no. Every revolutionary act begins with a no. And here in this story, two of the most powerless people in society, two women, stood up to the most powerful ruler in the world. And in true Hebraic fashion, the narrator tells us who is and who isn't consequential in the scene. Unlike Jacob and his 12 sons, all of whom are called out by name at the start of the story, the Egyptian king has no name. And once the story unfolds, it is Shipra and Puah who receive the honour of a name mention. I think the reason for that is because we are meant to pay close attention to them. Rulers come and go. Their names hardly matter. But these two women, Shipra and Puah, have their names written into history. They're about to effect a grand reversal of their own. We don't know much about the two women, except that they are remembered as Hebrew midwives. Hebrew, in fact, wasn't an ethnic designation so much as a socio-economic one. One commentator notes that Egyptian texts of the period refer to all slaves, whether Jewish or not, in general as Hebrews. So the unanimous agreement of these two women was to defy the edict of the king. This meant that they had to be organized. This meant they were doing an act of civil disobedience. They would defy Pharaoh with every delivery, Every refusal to look and discriminate based on gender became an act of holy defiance. Their resistance took the form of looking at each child with God's eyes, not the eyes of Pharaoh. It's a good thing that these women were skilled and organized. Defying Pharaoh required all their education and energy, all their strength and stamina. Since the Hebrew women, as we've read, kept conceiving and kept giving birth. These unlikely rebels defied Pharaoh in a sustained campaign for who knows how long in order to protect life. They let the boys live. For a long time, Pharaoh didn't even know he was losing. In her book, Defiant, written by Kelly Nicodema, she tells the story of civil disobedience. She writes this. Rosa Parks grew up watching buses. She would watch the school bus come from with the white students and take them to nice schools while she walked to an under-resourced school with the other black students. She grew up aware of racism, so evident in the Jim Crow laws of the South. And while she was quiet, she was never one to accept discrimination. She joined the local chapter of the NAACP, the National Association of the Advancement of Coloured People, in 1943 and became its secretary, the only position offered to her as a woman. About 10 years later, Emmett Till, a 14-year-old black boy, was lynched in Mississippi. The black community couldn't look away, nor could they be consoled at such a brutal loss. Rosa said that Emmett was on her mind that day in December 1955, when she sat on the bus after a long day's work. She was tired, she said, not from work, but from the weight of racism that oppressed her community. So when she was asked to move to the back of the bus to make room for white passengers, she refused. She moved over towards the window, allowing room for a passenger to easily sit next to her. But she wouldn't go to the back of the bus, like a second-class citizen. The bus driver threatened to call the police and have her arrested for her refusal to move. "You may do that," she said, "if you want to." Rosa was ready for resistance before she ever got on that bus. Rosa's Thursday evening arrest was a catalyst for the black community. Within days, community organisers decided on a bus boycott to coincide with Rosa's trial set for the following Monday. So on Sunday morning, local black churches had flyers announcing the boycott to congregants. On Sunday evening, there was a rally held at the Mount Zion Church, where a young preacher, Martin Luther King Jr., was given the pulpit for one of his first political speeches. He encouraged the congregation to boycott the buses all day on Monday in solidarity with Rosa as she stood trial. The black community boycotted the buses for 381 days until the Supreme Court ruled in favour of Rosa Parks, a ruling that resulted in the repeal of the segregated bus laws in Montgomery and then later in several other southern cities. That's the story of Rosa Parks, which is familiar, I'm sure, to many of you. But I wonder if you've ever stopped to consider what issues would make you consider such an act of civil disobedience. What kind of injustice would draw you out onto the streets to protest and march in solidarity with your community? There are so many injustices in our world, so many instances of discrimination, whether because of race or social standing, because of gender or sexual orientation. So many situations where we can see the principles of God's kingdom being ignored or trampled on. Too often, though, I think we remain quiet, and in so doing, we become complicit through our indifference. Oftentimes, we maybe take the view, of course, that anything we can do would only be a drop in the ocean compared with the enormity of the problem. That's certainly true when we come to consider issues like creation care and climate change. And yet we can learn a lot from the story of Shipra and Pua. Their decision to say no led to the saving of countless lives. And it's in this season of civil disobedience that the narrative moves on and we're led to consider the story of one saved life. At the start of chapter 2, we read these words. Now a man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. Once again, the story is economical on detail, but we get to know the names of Moses' parents later on in the book of Exodus, when in chapter 6 we read a list of the leaders of the Levi clan. Exodus chapter 6, verse 20 says this: Amram married his father's sister Jochebed, who bore him Aaron and Moses. Amram lived 137 years. The story of the first half of chapter 2 is so well known. But once again, we see that the main characters are women. We have Jochebed, Moses' mother, who her daughter, whose name we aren't told here, but later, of course, we know to be Miriam. And then we have Pharaoh's daughter. And if the action of Shipra and Puah were one of civil disobedience, then Jochebed's action was one of creative disobedience. At the end of chapter 1, Pharaoh, you'll remember, gives an order that every Hebrew boy was to be thrown in the Nile, which is, in a sense, exactly what Jochebed did. Her action, not only in making the basket, but also in sending her daughter along to keep watch, was one of tremendous faith. Having received her son as a gift from God, she then turns him over to his care. Jochebed would hardly have sent her daughter along to watch if she had expected her child to be murdered. Jochebed let her baby go because it was part of God's plan for helping him achieve his destiny. This little child was destined to become Israel's saviour. And from the story of Moses' birth, I think we learn at least three things about salvation. Things that perhaps we can look as being some of the features and signposts that we're noticing for our journey. Firstly, that God accomplishes salvation from within the story of human history. Secondly, that salvation is to be understood and framed in the context of resisting and defeating evil. And thirdly, it's important to notice that salvation is God's work from beginning to end. But once again, the historicity of the story of the book of Exodus comes under some scrutiny, since many historians take the view that because Moses isn't mentioned in any of the historical accounts left by the Egyptians, that must mean he's a figure of fiction rather than a figure of fact. But as I mentioned earlier, this isn't surprising. There are many gaps in the Egyptian records, especially when it comes to their embarrassing defeats. And it's also important to remember that the Bible itself proves reliable historical evidence. A great deal of the Bible, including the book of Exodus, is presented as history. When it comes to Moses, the Bible is very careful to describe that he was the great-grandson of Levi, who was one of the 12 sons of Jacob and the father of Israel's priests. Another good reason for believing in the historical Moses is his name. Firstly, it sounds like the Hebrew verb to draw out, masha. Pharaoh's daughter seems to have known a little Hebrew, for it was she who named him Moses, because she said, "I drew him out of water." But as one commentator points out, her Hebrew needs a little work, because Moses literally means he who draws out of. Unwittingly, Pharaoh's daughter gave the child a name that hinted at his destiny. Just as Moses himself was drawn out of water, so he would later draw God's people out of Egypt through the sea. And also, what is interesting historically about Moses' name is that it fits the Egyptian pattern for names in the royal court. The Hebrew named Moses sounds like the Egyptian word mos, which is derived from the verb to bear or to give birth to. The pharaohs often combined that word with the name of a god, as in the name, for instance, Ramses, which means the sun god Re has given birth to him. So the name Moses, therefore, has a double etymology that fits the historical context and provides further evidence for his existence in Egypt. Peter Enns, in his commentary, writes this concerning the importance of believing in an historical Moses. Some scholars say that it doesn't matter whether or not Moses ever existed. The book of Exodus is still a great story. But it makes more sense to say that if Moses never existed, then the Exodus doesn't matter. If the book is nothing more than a historical novel, it might make for interesting reading, but it would not have supernatural power to change anyone's life. The only God worth knowing is a God who has the power to work in human history to accomplish salvation. If God did not raise up a man named Moses to lead Israel out of Egypt, how can we be sure that he has the power to deliver us from our slavery to sin or to raise us up to eternal life? If our problems were literary ones, then a good story would be enough to solve them. But we live in time and space, and the difficulties we face are the difficulties of daily life, of loneliness, addiction, conflict, and grief. We need a God who can actually do something to help us. Now, as you can well imagine, there's so much that we could say about the start of this story, but I'm going to leave you with one image as we conclude this evening. There is a very powerful symbol of Pharaoh's failure, which you can go and see in the ruins of Luxor. There was an enormous statue of Ramesses II, but it has fallen down. Its face is crushed on the ground. Now, Ramesses may or may not have been the Pharaoh of the Exodus, but regardless, his broken statue is a monument to the story of the Exodus. It reminds us that it's God's story, not humankind's. It's a wonderful story that we get to share in because of God's love and mercy shown to us through Christ. I pray that over the next few weeks we will enjoy the story of Exodus as we just reconnect with the story of deliverance, as we see what it means for God's people to be drawn out from captivity in order to be brought into covenant. That is my prayer for all of us as we study this book together.